Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled, What in the World is USCIS International Operations? I'm JJ Area, AILA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The speakers for this podcast are Amanda Brill Shipley, the AILA USCIS International Operations Liaison Committee Chair from London, England, and Lynn M. Lee, the AILA Latin America and Caribbean Chapter Chair, and AILA USCIS International Operations Liaison Committee Vice Chair from Springfield, Virginia. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Amanda.
Thank you, JJ, and thank you, everybody, for listening. So the topic of our podcast is basically what in the world is USCIS International Operations, or USCIS Abroad. So Lynn and I have taken this topic on a roadshow around the world trying to educate AILA members because we do feel that it is an underutilized benefit for us as attorneys and for our clients. And so we thought we'd bring this little roadshow to a digital format. Now, some of you may remember the good old days when people could file I-130s at posts abroad, as well as 601 waivers, and most of that has been centralized. But one of the great tools that we have remaining to us as practitioners is that there are still 24 USCIS offices abroad, and a lot of them offer benefits that you're not probably aware of or aren't using to the best of your ability. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today and try to give you an overview of what the heck these offices do. So the major thing that we handle as part of our committee and as attorneys who do a lot of work abroad outside of the U.S. is the I-130. As I mentioned, there are still 24 USCIS offices abroad where you can directly file your I-130s. It used to be, as I mentioned, that you could file them at any Department of State location, and that was taken away in 2011. But currently, you can still direct file your I-130s at USCIS offices abroad, and they are in London, Frankfurt, Delhi, and so on and so forth. But the benefit of this is twofold. One is the processing times tend to be a lot faster. In London, it's about 2 months as compared to 5 months in the lockbox. And the other thing is that it takes it out of the National Visa Center, which we know can be kind of a graveyard for your immigrant visa processing. So that's one benefit. It's available to U.S. citizens who are residing in that jurisdiction with their foreign national spouses. Each post has its own procedure. Some are very helpfully posted both on the U.S. Embassy's website in that jurisdiction and USCIS.gov. It's a great thing that you can offer to your clients. They're very happy when you inform them of this. And we get to use it quite a bit. The other type of benefit that you may not be aware of with the I-130 is when you can file I-130s for exceptional circumstances. Lynn, did you want to talk a little bit about what exceptional circumstances are?
Sure. So exceptional circumstances, first of all, you only need to meet that if it's in a country where there is no USCIS office abroad. So Amanda mentioned there are 24 offices abroad, so it would be in one of the countries where there wasn't one of those offices. So let's take, as an example, if you look at Brazil, there's no USCIS office. The USCIS office in South America is in Lima. So if you had a client filing there, what you'd have to do is contact the Department of State and request if you could file it locally based on one of these exceptional circumstances. And those exceptional circumstances are, there's a memo on AILA.org, and it's a USCIS memo. If you just look up international USCIS International Operations, I-130s abroad, it should come up very easily, and it lists what the different reasonings are. The main one that we use, and Amanda, you know, tell me if you use another one very often, but is where there's either a new job in the U.S. for the U.S. citizen or a job transfer. So if the company is transferring the U.S. citizen back. And basically what it is if it's happening quickly. But by quickly, it means faster than it would have taken for the full process to go through within the U.S. So it's usually about 10 to 12 months, something like that, as long as you're going to take less time than that. So in a nutshell, the exceptional circumstance filing will allow you in certain situations to file that I-130 abroad if the Department of State accepts your request, then they, where you've asked for that, and then you send, the Department of State will actually contact the USCIS office that covers that region. In this scenario, it would have been Brazil would contact USCIS Lima and say, hey, can we take this case? They made it because they're being, you know, this company is sending the U.S. citizen back to the U.S. And then USCIS comes back to the Department of State and says, yes, you can accept it. And then the full process will happen in the country where the U.S. citizen is living. So which would be in this scenario, for instance, Brazil. So nothing would happen with USCIS except for USCIS granting the Department of State the permission to do so. So that was kind of a long-winded brief explanation, Amanda, but I hope that was kind of clear.
Yeah, no, I think that was great. I mean, it's not an easy process to explain. And we have a practice pointer that we put together as part of the International Operations Committee. And for people who love an AILA doc number, that number is 1308-0963. But again, as Lynn had mentioned, you can, you know, basically put into the search tool filing an I-130 abroad, and both that practice pointer and the Department of State's guidance and memo will come up and will provide you with specific details. But this, again, avoids going through the National Visa Center. We've seen for exceptional circumstance requests that as long as they make it through the right channels, I think the approval rate is about 85%. And that's for when you have to demonstrate exceptional circumstances. Within that, though, we've learned recently that, well, maybe in the last year or so, that there are kind of blanket exceptions where Department of State does not have to ask USCIS for permission to adjudicate the I-130s. And two of these are quite interesting and come up a lot. I know one is very close to your heart, Lynn, with all of your travel to Asia. but Japan, what, do you want to tell a little bit about that exception?
Sure. So one of the exceptions, that's a blanket exception, is for military. I-130 is filed for people related to the military, basically an I-130 spouse or parent or child over 21, son or daughter over 21 who's sponsoring their parent. And in those cases, basically what was happening was a lot of the USCIS office that covers Japan is actually in Korea, in South Korea, and they were getting inundated with these requests from Japan, the consulates in Japan saying, hey, can we process these cases? Because, you know, it was for those in the military, and that was one of the criteria, or that was one of the exceptions were met just by that. And so what USCIS decided to do in conjunction with the Department of State is they just said, okay, if there's someone is active duty in the military working on a military base, so that's important because somebody working, for instance, at the U.S. Embassy would not meet this criteria. But a U.S. military person working on a U.S. military base, or actually it just says a military base, it doesn't even say a U.S. military base, can apply for the, can submit the request to the Department of State in Japan, for instance, in this case, and Japan wouldn't have to ask USCIS. They could just go ahead and adjudicate it. The only thing that I'd like to point out is Japan, I use as the example here, because that's where this generally comes up. Most other places where there are U.S. military bases, there are USCIS offices. So, for instance, the U.K., Germany, Italy, the Philippines, Korea. So there's obviously other places where there are U.S. military bases, but the main place where we see this being very useful is in Japan.
Great. And then the other blanket exception that, we've had a lot of discussions about recently is for citizens of countries where they're deemed to be basically danger. I forget the term of art. Do you remember, Lynn?
Disrupting events.
Okay.
A large
and
disrupting
so,
event. Yeah.
Oh, yes, large-scale disrupting event. And so these are instances where the beneficiary is a citizen of Syria, Libya, Yemen, or Iraq, I think they just added.
Yep, they just added that.
And our understanding was always, you know, prior to our most recent meeting with International Operations, which was in November, and we meet with them at their headquarters twice a year. In our most recent meeting, we learned about some industrious Yemenis who were using this process. And so basically, it's similar to the military blanket exception for exceptional circumstances. Where if you are a citizen of Syria, Libya, Yemen, or Iraq, and you had a spouse or, you know, immediate relative who was filing an I-130 on your behalf, the Department of State would not have to ask USCIS if there were exceptional circumstances. Instead, they would be able to accept jurisdiction of the I-130. Now, we always understood that to mean that they kind of had to accept jurisdiction of the I-130 and no exceptional circumstances had to be proven. But due to this interesting scenario where the Yemeni citizens were filing a lot of the, or having these filed on their behalf in Djibouti, USCIS International Ops sort of got wind of this. I guess there was, I like to believe that there was some industrious lawyer in America who actually knew that this was happening, because we often deal with the fact that nobody knows what we're doing abroad, and spread the word. And I guess there were many filings for these in Djibouti on behalf of Yemeni citizens. And so we've definitely seen that USCIS has been very clear about the fact that not only do these people have to be citizens of these nations, but they have to prove that they have exceptional circumstances on top of that. So I think one of the examples they gave, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Lynn, but was of, you know, a family who was living happily in Sweden, for example, and wanted to take advantage of exceptional circumstances, but there was no real threat or urgency, then USCIS and Department of State actually would have the discretion to not allow the I-130 to process at that post. Is that how you understood it,
yeah,
Lynn?
Yeah, and there, I think there's another interesting thing to kind of look at in relation to this point, which is for all of the other cases that relate to all of this, where you can decide where you're filing, whether it's a country where there is a USCIS office or not, it's based on where the U.S. citizen petitioner is living. But in these cases where it's the large disrupting event, it's based on the eligibility of being able to meet this criteria is based on what the citizenship is of the beneficiary. Or at least that was my understanding, Amanda.
Exactly.
And so that's I think, a critical piece as well, because with all of the other cases, it relates solely to where the U.S. citizen petitioner is living. If the U.S. citizen is in the U.S., then you can't use it at all. You know, if the U.S. citizen is in a country where there is no USCIS office, then it has to, you know, meet the exceptional circumstance, whereas this is a bit of a different animal. And so Yeah, I think the issue was they only want people to be using this large disrupting event scenario where the people are actually in, you know, a dire situation, not where they have residency in a very safe place and, you know, could remain there for the next year.
Right. And actually, I recently heard from an AILA member who had tried to file an I-130 at a post in a different country. And so one of the things you always have to keep in mind with these exceptional circumstance filings is that Department of State can only adjudicate and approve an I-130 that's clearly approvable. And I think a lot of times we forget, I mean, I'm obviously based in London. I do the bulk of my work in Europe. Usually my clients are, you know, professionals who earn a certain amount of money. And, you know, there's not a high risk of fraud at all. They got married in either America or a European country. And so the clearly approvable rarely comes into issue with my cases. But one of the AILA members who got in touch with me had a case, I believe it was a Libyan citizen who had gotten married in Crete, and they were filing in Cairo. And so Cairo has now sent, the case was not deemed to be clearly approvable, and so the case was sent to Rome, which we learned at our most recent meeting handles the not clearly approvable cases. So I think it's kind of interesting how it all fits together. And I think when you have a case that is not so straightforward, these get a little more complicated. And obviously that's going to happen when you have people in countries where they're fleeing or otherwise, you know, not citizens. But we always say, you know, that there's no risk in asking. You know, basically how these cases get processed is you would make a request to the Department of State, as Lynn had mentioned earlier, where you're asking them to adjudicate the case. They sometimes want to see evidence of the exceptional circumstances, you know, in your initial request. Sometimes they have a more established process for reviewing these. Each post is going to be completely different. Some posts won't even know that it exists, although we're finding that more and more the word is out. But when you submit the request, you know, they're either going to say yes or no, or not respond to you for a month. But if if you get a response, it's a yes or no. It's if it's a yes, you've saved your client, you know, probably 9 months of going through the lockbox and NVC and then Department of State for the immigrant visa. But if they say no, then, you know, you really haven't lost much except possibly a little bit of time, because then you just file with the lockbox and you resume normal processing. So it's something you shouldn't be afraid of doing, because the consequence of it being a no is not so severe.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Amanda, is that people shouldn't be worried that if they get a no on the exceptional request, that means that there's a mark on their case, on the actual I-130 case or anything. It just means that, no, you'll have to file it within the U.S. I think sometimes people do feel like that might, you know, be a problem. Quite frankly, the lockbox will probably never even know that you ever tried to file it, you know, through the embassy abroad.
Right. Exactly. And so I think, you know, the one thing, you know, as I mentioned, is the risk is often no response at all, and that can take time. So what we've established with International Operations Headquarters is if you're not getting a response from the Department of State, you know, first and foremost, and this sounds obvious, but I think it's sometimes difficult to know how to contact an embassy. I know, for example, one of our committee members had some issues with Paris. And, you know, this information is not always clear. So you want to make sure you have the right contact information to start with. If you're unsure and you're really struggling, you know, we always put a plug in for our international chapters. There's the Bangkok District Chapter, the RDC EMEA Chapter, and the Latin American Caribbean Chapter. Most of the members of these chapters have probably tried this at one of the posts or may have the contact information. So you want to make sure you get that right first. We always recommend that you reach out to the post 2 or 3 times to see if you get an answer. If you're not getting an answer in that situation, then you are within your rights to contact the USCIS office that has jurisdiction over that location. And that information can be found pretty easily just by Googling USCIS International Operations. They have a very detailed breakdown of their offices and what jurisdictions they cover. So in that instance, you would want to reach out to USCIS that has jurisdiction. And I would say probably 90% of the time, at least from the feedback we get from people, and we all know that lawyers are not afraid to complain, but mainly, you know, they get a response at that point, and USCIS will sort of reach over to Department of State to ask for, you know, the request. If you're having trouble at that point and you've, you know, documented very well your attempts to submit this request, then we would recommend that you get in touch with us through ALA Liaison, and we'll take a look at what you've submitted and see if we can't help you. Our experience with international operations is that they are very, very generous and very helpful, and also very considerate of Americans living abroad, I feel. And so they will usually, you know, help out if they've seen that, you know, the attempts have not worked at, you know, Department of State and USCIS in the field offices. Did you have anything to add to that, Lynn? Or
no, I think that was that pretty much summed that up. I think that was perfect.
Okay, cool. All right, so we can talk a little bit more. I think that's mostly what we learned at our most recent meeting, building upon the sort of overview. But we can talk a little bit. I know it's Lynn's favorite topic. So fees, Lynn. We have a few updates about fees, or at least you can explain what the challenges are with fees when dealing with USCIS.
Yes. It is my favorite.
And the recent
topic.
Changes in okay. London.
So fees can become a real pain because, you know, if you can't submit the fee properly or how the USCIS International Office abroad wants it or requests it, you know, your case doesn't get feed in, and then, you know, it's not processing. So the problem is through some various different cases where there had been problems, we learned that USCIS is required to accept payment. However, the Department of State accepts payment in that at that particular consulate. So, for instance, in a case that I had one that was filed in Mexico City and one that was filed in Ciudad Juarez, and actually the process is how we had to make that payment, who the payment was payable to, were different, despite them being in the same filed in the same country, because the Department of State in Mexico City accepted payment differently than the Department of State in Ciudad Juarez. So it's important to always look on the website to make sure that you have the most up-to-date information on what is being accepted or used as the payment process. Now, the change that recently happened in London, and I don't know that this will happen in a lot of other places because London's a little special in that USCIS London actually does not want individuals to come to submit their I-130 application. They want it to be sent via post. And so as a result of that, payment obviously needs to be made, you know, without somebody going in person. Most countries, most USCIS offices abroad don't work like that. Some do, and you always, as Amanda said, always want to look on the USCIS International Office website because it's updated. It's probably one of the most accurate websites, U.S. government websites because they, mm-hmm. they really try to keep that up to date. And so I would encourage people to do that. But so in this scenario with London, basically what has changed is the embassy or the Department of State in London will no longer accept payment for credit card payments for fees without the person being at the embassy in person, meaning you can't submit the credit card form and just have the information written down. So one workaround, obviously, is people can show up to the consulate to pay and submit the packet. Obviously, that creates other issues because you might not have an appointment then. And we've been talking with USCIS International Ops about that, how individuals might be able to submit that in person because they might not even be allowed into the consulate in order to make that payment and submission. The other suggestion that has been brought up that we've asked them, and Amanda, please clarify if you've heard that they are permitting this because you being in London yourself, but is paying by debit card because the U.S. Embassy does accept debit card payments. So the thought was, well, if the U.S. Embassy accepts debit card payments, then so should the U.S. Embassy on behalf of USCIS. So, Amanda, have you had any – this all changed within basically the last 4 to 6 weeks, so you may not have had an example, but have you heard of or used a debit card for any cases?
Not with USCIS, and actually my passion has been reignited on this issue because the interesting thing is at USCIS in London, they've expressed that they'll accept, I think, a post office money order, U.S. post office money order, a U.S. cashier's check, or an international bank draft in U.S. dollars. And I know maybe some of you have lived your life without ever having to deal with British banking and may be blessed for that, but it is the biggest pain to try to get an international bank draft in U.S. dollars with any kind of timeliness in the U.K. So, you know, one thing I would suggest, and this will only fall to a handful of people who are practicing abroad, but it probably is relevant anywhere in the world if you're filing any of these things abroad. Check in advance, as Lynn mentions, about how fees are accepted, because the worst thing you can do is wait until it's being filed and find out that it takes 7 to 10 business days to get the appropriate form of payment to submit the application. And it's definitely something – we were able to do it in an hour and a half. At Citibank, which there is one location of in London. But, you know, I think the important thing is that, you know, with the fees going up, especially December 23rd, you know, you just want to be prepared because even though this seems like an issue that you don't really have to consider when you file everything within the U.S., it is definitely a consideration when you start dealing with this abroad, especially when you have both USCIS and Department of State involved, it can create some issues that you probably never could have imagined. But we'll work on the debit. That's my new goal.
Well, and it is difficult with the two of those three items being things that had to originate in the U.S. I mean, that's a clear complication. And you know, I've had that problem before because I was working outside of the U.S. as well, and even when we had an office inside the U.S. obtain a check from the U.S., it still wasn't accepted. So there is some people might think this is not much of a problem, you know, but if you think about it, how can you get a U.S. money order, postal money order, you know, if you and your clients are living outside of the U.S., other than, you know, someone setting up a business, which I've now thought of adding that but you know, for people, because it's kind of ridiculous. So yeah, we'll just one more of those fun issues to tackle.
Exactly. Well, obviously, we know a lot and are very passionate about I-130s being filed abroad, but international operations does other things. And so we wanted to spend a little time just sort of flagging those. Obviously, we won't go into as much detail, but just so you're aware as practitioners about what else the international operations offices do abroad, we wanted to kind of flag those. Now, one thing is international adoption. And Lynn and I have both been on this committee for AILA as the liaison committee for years now. We do not do anything with international adoptions. There is a designated person on our committee who is brilliant and works on those issues, but it is such a niche practice area that we don't work on it. But it's something that we just wanted to highlight in case people have any issues with international adoptions. That's under their jurisdiction as well. Travel letters, Lynn. Do you want to talk a little bit about travel letters and the I-131A?
Sure. So there's been a recent change, and basically what used to happen, which many of you probably are aware, is if your client, for instance, is a green card holder and lost their green card or it was stolen while they were abroad, they would contact the consulate where they are, and they would be able to get a travel letter or a boarding foil. What was interesting is, or maybe confusing is a better term, is that depending on which embassy this was occurring at, this was being requested from, it could have been handled by either CBP in that location, ICE, USCIS, or the Department of State. So it just depended on that particular consulate. You know, for instance, there's only 24 USCIS offices. Obviously, if it was a location where there was no USCIS office, they wouldn't be handling it, and that sort of thing. So it was always very, it could always be a little bit difficult obtaining that transportation letter, especially quickly in the sense of not knowing necessarily that process. The websites weren't always up to date with Department of State and things of that nature. Now, what they've decided to do is put in a formal process where either USCIS or the Department of State are the only two that will be issuing these. But there is a formal application, which there did not used to be. There is going to be a filing fee, which they did not used to have. You must file through ELIS, which for those who don't know is the portal that USCIS has created as they're doing a digital form or electronic form, and you have to file through that manner. It has had, we understand, some various glitch problems, and one that they mentioned in our meeting was the applicant is supposed to put their name as it is written on the green card, to make sure that no matter what it is on any other document, whatever it is on the green card is what the individual is using. Even in that scenario, we found out that there have been some issues, and so you might need to do some other troubleshooting, contacting USCIS directly about it. But, you know, obviously this is a little bit concerning for us because, A, we don't want our clients to have to all of a sudden have to pay a fee where they didn't have to, but I mean that's out of our control. And then also, you know, before, as long as we filed the appropriate process, it usually took a day or two, something like that. Whereas now, you know, we're a bit concerned that it could take longer, you know, as more people are having to file these potentially, and there's a whole process in place, and that, you know, there could just be a clog in the system at some point. So that's a little bit of our concern, but, you know, we are hopeful that that this process will work through and get kind of established pretty quickly. And you know, hopefully as time goes on and as we get more feedback from people, AILA members like yourselves who are listening, you know, if you're having problems, you know, contact us. I will say in this interim time period after they've announced it, this change, there are still some locations where CBP or ICE may still be processing these in the short term, For instance, we looped with London back in September, and CBP was still doing it with London back in September. I don't know as of December 2nd, as we're recording this. But and then they said in our meeting that in Jamaica, for instance, CBP is currently, I think it was CBP, not ICE, but anyway, either CBP or ICE was still doing those cases in at that location. So you may see some just changes kind of dragging a little bit, depending on what's happening at that post. Did that kind of clarify that, Amanda?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks, Lynn. okay, we have a few minutes left. So one thing I wanted to touch base with briefly is the I-601. So again, those have mostly been centralized, but there are, USCIS offices abroad still have the ability to adjudicate these in exceptional circumstances. The one thing, if you're still listening, that I forgot to mention at the beginning is, yes, there are 24 offices abroad, but these are very, very small offices, usually staffed by, no more than, I think, four people. It's usually two or three people who are working in these offices. So when we keep mentioning exceptional, 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 it's because of the workload issue. I mean, they just don't have the capacity to do all the things that we would love for them to do. So, again, 601 waivers in exceptional circumstances, and there is another practice pointer about that if it arises, but it has to be at a USCIS office, not through Department of State. And then, Lynn, would you like to give us a little bit of information about the N-400?
Sure. Before you do that, I was going to give the doc number for those who love it about the 601 memo.
Nice one.
Regarding exceptional, basically like the exceptional circumstance kind of thing. It's 12053142. 12053142, and it also includes I-212s also. And again, the individual has, as Amanda was saying, the individual has to be living in a country where there's a USCIS office. There's no exceptional circumstance in the sense of being able to file it where there isn't a USCIS office. But okay, regarding the N-400, it's a very short point to bring up that they alerted us to at our most recent meeting, which is that they've advised that as of the very end of December, that's in quotes, it was the very end of December, so I don't know if that literally means the 31st or what, but that USCIS will start accepting N-400 applications online, so that's kind of a big deal because they've been kind of preparing for this process, and obviously it will then lead into other forms and that being expanded to N-400 for those not in the military. But anyway, the initial grouping will be military naturalization. And I believe, Amanda, they advise that's not just for the person in the military themselves, but also for their spouse or children.
Right, exactly. And then we're going to conclude on one of the things that we spent many, many years working on, and people may not be aware of, but the whole issue with overseas biometrics. So obviously this mostly arises with reentry permits. They're filed stateside, and the applicant has to leave immediately, and they don't want to return to have their biometrics collected in the U.S. So after many, many, many years, this is now allowed, and actually it's now, it's not just allowed, they didn't have the equipment in place to do it. So the tools are there. They can collect biometrics. But this is beyond exceptional. I think, it has to be a very unique situation. Can't just be the person doesn't want to travel. It's usually not going to work for the business traveler because I think it's presumed that, if you're a business traveler, what's the big deal of hopping on a plane? But they would like to, but it is another situation where if you live in a jurisdiction with a USCIS office and you do want to make the request that the biometrics be collected abroad, you can do so if you can show that there are exceptional circumstances or extraordinary circumstances or unique circumstances. But what they would see, I think, to what they would need to see to grant that would probably be something along the lines of, you know, a full family having to return to the U.S. from a very distant location, or a medical issue or something like that. So they definitely didn't want to open up the floodgates, and it is a benefit. But we do want to flag that issue in case your clients have a situation where it would be very difficult for them to get back to have their biometrics collected. So I think that does it for us today. We rushed to the last points, but I think the most important thing we want to get across is the I-130s. But thank you very much for listening, and this will conclude our podcast.